Today on Maine Calling, 2 centuries of cultural history in Maine. Maine has a well-known lineup of major artists and creators, but some are not so well-known, yet played a significant role in the state's history of painting, sculpture, photography, and architecture over the last 200 years. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program we'll talk with Maine State historian Earl Shuttleworth about some of these names, such as sculptors Paul Akers and Franklin Simmons, pioneering photographers Chansonetta Stanley Emmons and Emma Lewis Coleman, and the architect Charles G. Bryant. We'll also explore the contributions of some of the state's prominent painters, from Thomas Cole to Rockwell Kent to Marsden Hartley. And we'll explore some of the state's most important writers, from Stephen King to Richard Ford. An overview of Maine's cultural history. Maine Calling is coming up.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to island and coastal Downey's communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. When we talk about Maine's history, the focus is often on political or military history. Today we turn to culture and the arts, and learn more about the evolution of these fields and some of the people whose creative work has had lasting influence. Joining me is Earl Shuttleworth, Maine's longtime state historian. He was first appointed in 2004, and he has lectured and written extensively on Maine history and architecture. We invite you to join the conversation. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call. The number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Thanks for joining us, Earl. Great to talk to you again.
My pleasure.
I'd like to start, I guess, with kind of a big question about history and ask you whether the sort of practice of history in general, as we mentioned about politics or social movements, is it different in any way from art history, where opinions, about an artist's influences or even what they're trying to say in the art seem to me, on the face of it, somewhat more subjective than the other disciplines? What's your take on that?
Well, I think that in terms of writing history, as you've already mentioned, Keith, there are a number of categories, a number of approaches, political, military, social, and certainly art history. And art history, I think, is written through the lens of the work of artists, whether they're sculptors or whether they're painters or whatever. And then you categorize, in this case, we're talking about Maine. So we're really zeroing in on a tradition that starts really in the 18th century and continues today in terms of creativity, and also, of course, goes much further back with the native peoples. But what we're doing is looking at what was created in a particular time frame, and then basically imposing an order to that and an interpretation, and thus creating a history, a written history. And it's inevitably subjective. It's in the eyes of the historian who is creating that history.
And as you said, there'll be many names that come up today. Some are familiar from school. Some are familiar from our lives or famous artists. But some are not as well known. And we hope to learn some about those creative forces and the influences that they've had. But just to advise the listener, we may be moving swiftly through certain areas that But I just want to be clear that we've got so much to cover that that's why we're doing it. And as you mentioned, as we'll focus a lot on post-1820, the formation of the state of Maine, but the history of creativity and art goes thousands of years earlier than that. And talk about, if you would, the art of the indigenous art of the Wabanaki and how we see it today.
Yeah, well, I think there are several examples. First, we know from the archaeological work that's been done in the state that Native peoples began to create ceramic objects as far as 3,000 years ago, and the remains of these are found in archaeological sites. Maybe more like 1,000 years or so ago, some Native peoples created petroglyphs, for example, particularly in the Washington County area, rock art, the creation of images on stone, on rocks. And then, of course, there's a great tradition of basket making, which is still very much a part of our culture today. And in fact, you can go to either the Portland Museum of Art or the Farnsworth Museum this summer and see wonderful exhibits of Native Maine art creation through basket making.
Maine is, as a place, is often described as a sort of a place of inspiration for artists, particularly painters, but photographers and others. Is there a reason for that, you know, beyond its striking landscape or maybe the lighting? Or what is it about Maine that has made it a magnet for creators?
Well, I think to answer that question, Keith, we need to go back really to the early 19th century, to just about the time of statehood in the 1820s. This was a period when American and Maine landscape painting was just developing. And in fact, some of the earliest American landscape painters, some of the really important ones like Thomas Cole, Thomas Birch, and others, came from Boston, New York, from Philadelphia, up to the Maine coast, because they had heard that the Maine coast was this rugged, powerful place that had great, almost romantic qualities to its topography. And indeed, they were rewarded by this. And you find, beginning in the 1820s, 30s, 40s, these major American painters spending time on the Maine coast. And then that's followed by a second generation, which includes, again, major painters such as Frederick Church, who does some wonderful work, not only on the coast, but also Church then in the 1850s goes inland to Katahdin, Katahdin being a great draw for artists as well in the mid to late 19th century. So I think to answer your question, there really is this Maine mystique that attracts the earliest artists. But at the same time, in the 1820s, concurrent with the beginnings of visiting artists, we also have our first major resident landscape artist, Charles Codman, comes from Boston to Portland in 1822 and starts painting landscapes in the mid-1820s and does so until his death in 1842. And he leaves a large body of work that includes both actual realistic views of Maine landscape, it's a great view of Sebago Lake, for example, but at the same time, he also creates sort of fanciful landscapes as well.
And you mentioned Thomas Cole at the top. Now, he's the founder of the Hudson River School, which sort of, you know, idealized the grandeur of the natural wilderness. And so that's really the driving force behind trying to find these landscapes or seascapes in this case.
Absolutely. Yes. No, there's a very powerful romantic movement in American art in the second quarter of the 19th century, 1820s, 30s, 40s. Gould dies in 1848, but he's up here before then doing work on Mount Desert.
Yeah. So then emerged these artist colonies in places like Ogunquit and Monhegan. This is later in the century, from which this new class of landscape painters emerged. Talk a little bit about what the colonies were and how they worked, and were they kind of incubators for a different take on
Yeah,
landscape?
well, I think they varied in nature. Some of the colonies were based around a particular artist or small group of artists who were actually teachers. For example, probably the first art colony in a sense that we can identify is out on Cushing Island in Portland Harbor in the 1880s, when a group of artists come from the Chicago Art Institute and offer classes for the summer on Cushing's Island. And then, of course, you go to Monhegan and you find, of course, artists are beginning to discover Monhegan even before the Civil War. But as far as an art colony is concerned, it really seems to emerge right around 1900, the early 1900s. For example, important American artists of that period, like Rockwell Kent and George Bellows, go out there to paint, and in the Robert Henri also, and in the case of Rockwell Kent, he and a fellow artist actually for one season in the early 1900s actually run an art school out there, and it's at that point that he builds a studio, which is still there today as part of the Monhegan Museum. Other important colonies, of course, include Ogunquit, and there were two very powerful forces there. One was Hamilton Easterfield, and then there was another artist as well who gave classes. They had very different approaches to their art. The other one was Charles Woodberry. Woodberry was very much an impressionist. Hamilton Easterfield was more a modernist of the early 20th century, but they both had many followers, many people who went to their classes and became inspired to paint from their summer activities.
And then, moving into the 20th century, there are names that we all know: Winslow Homer, Edward Hopper, and of course the Wyeths, starting with N.C. and Andrew, and still now Jamie Wyeth. Is there a thread that connects any of them other than time?
Well, I think there maybe a thematic approach in that you have Homer coming to Prout's Neck to begin to paint there seriously in 1883. Right at that time, he creates the studio, which is of course now available to the public through the Portland Museum of Art, and he basically spends a good part of his life from 1883 until his death in 1910, painting at Prout's Neck. His approach is to stay in one place. Now, of course, at different seasons of the year, he does travel. He travels to the Adirondacks, he travels to the tropics, and so on. But basically, his great focus is at Prout's Neck in that period. And he chooses a very small geographic area to concentrate upon, to learn every aspect of its topography, its life, its inspiration to him. This is really not unlike what Andrew Wyeth did in Cushing, in which he chose basically to stay in one place through a good deal of his main career, although later in life he does go out to Allen and Benner's Island, and he does other work, but basically he's choosing, like Homer, a very circumscribed geographic area in Maine to create within.
There are other connections. I've seen, I think I saw a show highlighting, it might have been Hopper and Wyeth together. I saw, I think there's been written about Georgia O'Keeffe, who we haven't mentioned yet, and Marston Hartley, who were very different, but traveled in the same circles and were, influential at the same time. So there are connections, thematic connections, as you point out, between artists, even though they may not, they may, their work might be very different.
Yes, very true. Certainly, with Marston Hartley and with Georgia O'Keeffe, briefly they were both in A Gun Quick in the 19-teens, in the World War I period. Although, of course, their art is quite different. Hartley, in particular, is a fascinating story in that he was born in Lewiston in 1877. His parents had come from England, his father to work in the textile industry. And for a long time, he's just gradually developing as an artist in Maine. Then he goes to New York. Then he goes to Europe, particularly to Germany before World War I. And then he becomes really a sort of artistic wanderer, which he goes to many different places to paint, and then ultimately in the late 30s comes back and concentrates on Maine until his death in 1943. As an artist, he is very innovative, very dynamic in his approach. A lot of his work is very simple and very powerful in the way it is composed and in the way it is brought forward. And he's considered now one of the major American artists of the 20th century. And this is certainly reflected in the great desirability of his work when it becomes available.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break there. I do want to talk about photography after this and a little bit of literature right after the break. But we are going to take a quick break now. My guest, the state historian Earl Shuttleworth. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. I'm talking today with Maine state historian Earl Shuttleworth. He's taking us through the cultural history of Maine, highlighting painting, sculpture, photography, and architecture. Join the conversation. Email us at talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Joining us now on the line is Caroline Bix, University of Maine's Stephen E. King Chair in Literature. Caroline Bix, thank you for joining us.
That's my pleasure.
So I'm going to suggest maybe that you would make a case for Stephen King as a major figure in Maine's cultural history, if not the.
That's going to be really hard to do.
But talk to us then about why that is. What's
Right.
the why is he a major figure?
Right. Well, I mean, you have to contextualize him in the bigger landscape, of course, of Maine writing. But what he brings, what he revolutionizes to the genre of horror is he's setting his iconic stories in ordinary Maine towns, right? So he's bringing vampires and telekinetic teenage girls and evil pet cemeteries right to our backyards. And that's really revolutionary in terms of the genre of horror. But what makes him different and what he's bringing to the table is that his characters, they're coming across as real people facing real problems in their small, often, isolated, ordinary Maine communities. So he's not doing the wealthy coastal Maine community kind of writing that we do get from other writers. He's intensely regional in what he's doing, but in that way, he's also connecting to larger American problems, right? I mean, Carrie could have been a bullied American teenager anywhere in America. But he
Right.
makes Carrie living in Chamberlain, Maine, right, and going to Chamberlain High School. And in that way, the town and its characters and the community become as much an important part of the story as Carrie herself. And Maine becomes a character. And I think he popularized Maine for people who don't know Maine around the world, right? But a different Maine than what E.B. White or McCloskey were popularizing.
Hmm. And he influenced other writers that came later.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think you can see his impact, you know, in being that intense American regionalist writer. He's impacting other writers that are coming after him, like Elizabeth Strout with Olive Kittredge, you know, or Monica Wood. So many writers have attributed him to, you know, how they are thinking about Maine, their characters, their conflicts, and America.
Yeah. So, but King is not the first Maine writer to popularize a genre of a certain genre of
Absolutely
American
not. Yes, and I was going to say, I mean, Sarah Orne Jewett really is one of the, you know, notably one of the first American writers and a Maine writer, she's from South Berwick, to popularize that kind of American literary regionalism. I mean, her Country of the Pointed Firs, I believe that's 1896. And that really was important for portraying a provincial and kind of, you know, failing seacoast town. So certainly he's not the first. He's part of a tradition. He's building on that tradition. He's bringing horror to the mix and monsters who have a way of touching, you know, becoming lightning rods for larger human and regional problems. But yeah, he's definitely part of that larger tradition.
Who would you point to now as Maine writers who are having an impact on the state's culture?
I mean, I would absolutely want to call out Morgan Talty, who has just joined our UMaine faculty. We're incredibly lucky to have him, an enormously talented creative writer. He just has come out. I think tomorrow is his pub date for Fire Exit, his novel, which is already getting national attention. You know, he writes in and around the Penobscot Nation's Indian Island Reservation, where he grew up. So I would say he is absolutely one to watch. You know, I'm not. He's just a beautiful writer, and bringing a different kind of region to national attention.
Mm. And I saw in notes you would also suggest Heather Cox Richardson.
Oh, Heather Cox Richardson, my hero. Yes. I mean, she's doing a different kind of writing. I mean, she's been writing her letters. She's a, for those people who don't know her, she's a historian of American history. She teaches at Boston College, but she was raised in Maine and lives in Maine. And she's been writing these daily letters from an American starting in 2019. And really what she does is she grounds and informs us in the crises that are going on in American democracy right now. She's so calm and so reflective and so thorough. It's like a master class every time you read her newsletters. And she has over 1.2 million subscribers. So that's a different kind of writing, obviously. But
Well, thank you so much for your input. I really appreciate it. Thanks for joining us. Caroline Bix is a UMaine Stephen King Chair in Literature. Earl, did you have anything you wanted to add after that?
No, I thought her comments were excellent, and I'm very pleased that she talked about Sarah Orne Jewett, who is such an important regionalist, really projecting a changing, fading Maine in the late 19th century.
I want to go back to the visual arts here and this idea that maybe some of the same draw that brought painters to Maine may have brought photographers here later on. But as you have chronicled, actually photographers came, the early photographers started out largely doing portraiture.
Yeah, actually, to give a little bit of background, photography in its first popular form was known as the daguerreotype, and that was actually unveiled as a photographic process in Paris in 1839, and very quickly brought to America that year by actually by a painter, Samuel F.B. Morse, who also was the inventor of the telegraph. And it just took off like wildfire in America. And literally by early 1840, there is a photographer primarily taking photographic portraits who starts out in Portsmouth but crosses the Piscataqua River and comes up to Portland and becomes our first commercial photographer. Now, from the period of about 1840 up into the 1880s, photography is largely the purview of professional photographers who are doing it commercially. And it does divide into several categories. The primary ones, of course, are portrait photographs. People want their picture taken. But also, there is what we would call landscape photography or topographic photography, which is views of towns and cities, houses, streetscapes, industries, so on. And one of the great aspects of this, beginning in the 1860s and going to the 1880s, is what we call the stereo view. The double-framed card that goes in the viewer became immensely popular. And in fact, the Maine Historic Preservation Commission in Augusta now has a collection of approximately 20,000 different stereo views of Maine, a great photographic record of what the state looked like in the 19th century. However, photography changes quite dramatically in the 1880s with the development of what we call the dry plate process. Prior to that, from the 1850s to the 1880s, negatives had to be processed very quickly after they were exposed. I mean, we think of the Civil War photography, for example, with Matthew Brady having to take his rolling studio out into the battlefield and actually do the negative shortly after they're shot. But the dry plate, which in part is developed by the Stanley brothers in Lewiston, who later on, after they sell the rights to the dry plate to Eastman Kodak, they then invent the Stanley steamer, the famous automobile. But the dry plate really liberates photographers, both professionally and non-professionally, to go out and take pictures and then be able to process the negatives later on. And so you have this wonderful rise of, and I hate to use the word amateur because they were really non-commercial photographers, but they were very gifted photographers. And this is not just men, but a really outstanding group of women. Beginning in the 1880s, people like Emma Sewell from Bath, Chansonetta Stanley Emmons, who is the sister of the Stanley brothers, based in Kingfield, and Emma Lewis Coleman, who, although she's in the Boston area, does a lot of work in southern Maine, is a close friend of Sarah Ann Jewett, and actually kind of creates photographs that are based upon some of Jewett's novels. And these are just three of many talented men and women who take up photography from the 1880s into the early 1900s. And thank goodness they did, because they created this extraordinary record, a pictorial record of Maine.
There was also, I noticed, this sort of dark, macabre, I guess you'd say, type of portrait called post-mortem, and this was
Oh, yes.
explain what that was and
Well,
why.
this actually starts out at the very beginning of portrait photography. Of course, what we have to remember is that in the 1840s and 50s, death was never very far away. It was a very different societal situation where, you know, there were a lot of disease, a lot of death in daily life, and people were actually encouraged by the commercial photographers to come have their picture taken while they were still living. But if that didn't work out and someone had passed away without having their photograph taken, the photographers would oblige by actually coming to their homes and taking pictures of them after their death. And there's a whole a body of these photographs that go way back to the 1840s to the daguerreotype period, but continue into the early 1900s with other forms of photography, and you run across these quite frequently, and they are very sobering.
Yeah. Let's move to sculpture now, which gets less attention than painting, it seems. But just immediately, because I live in Thomaston, I live in the mid-coast, names like Louise Nevelson and Bernard Langley come to mind. We were family friends with Bernard Langley, and so I know the house well there. But long before these names emerged were sculptors that were really notable for reasons that you're about to explain, but that we might never have heard of. And I wonder if you
Yeah.
could start with Paul Akers, who is.
Yeah, and actually, Keith, I might go just back a little bit further, in that sculpture in Maine, in the broader sense, really is something that began in the 18th century with the gravestone carving tradition. And we do know the names of some of these early carvers, such as Noah Pratt, who in the late 18th century did very distinctive carved gravestones in the Freeport area. And then we move on in the early 19th century to a whole tradition that extends through the 19th century of what we generally call ship carvers or figurehead carvers. And some of these men, for example, Charles A.L. Sampson from Bath in the mid-19th century were extraordinarily gifted creators. We know, for example, that Sampson carved at least 26 figureheads from the 1850s till his death in the 1880s for Bath vessels. But this is more a kind of vernacular art. Or commercial art. What we're talking about in terms of artistic sculpture really begins with an artist in Maine named Paul Akers. He comes out of the southern Maine area. He starts his work in the 1840s, then spends a good deal of his life over in Italy in the 1850s, and then dies in 1861. So he has a very brief career, a little more than a decade, but in that period, he creates some very important American sculpture of the mid-19th century. Probably his most famous work is The Dead Pearl Diver, which is at the Portland Museum of Art. In fact, it was the very first acquisition of the museum back in the 1880s when it began and has been a very popular piece for people to visit ever since. And from Akers, then a number of other Maine sculptors emerge. Probably the most famous one after Akers' death is Franklin Simmons. And of course, his work is very evident in Portland, in the Civil War Monument in Monument Square, and in the Longfellow Monument in Longfellow Square. Simmons was a major figure in American sculpture, based most of his life in Rome, very prolific, did important work that is included in the U.S. Capitol.
Yeah, he in the rotunda is his bust of Ulysses Grant.
Actually, it's a full-size
Full
statue
size?
of
Yeah.
Grant. Yeah, and it has an interesting story with it in that he was commissioned by the Congress to create a memorial statue, full life-size statue of Grant after Grant died in 1885. And Mrs. Grant was very involved in the commission. And so over in his studio in Rome, he created this really beautiful statue of Ulysses Grant, and then it was shipped over to the Capitol, and they opened up the crate, and various senators and representatives and officials in the Capitol looked upon it and said, "Oh no, this is not quite what we wanted," because for one thing, he was less formal, and he was even seen, some people even interpret him that he had this almost like this sorrowful expression on his face, and so consequently they rejected that statue and sent it back to Rome, and then he created a second one, which was more serious, more had more military associations with it and all in its iconography, and that was then shipped to the Capitol, and that's the one that's there today. But Maine was the beneficiary of the first refused statue, in that when Simmons died in 1913, he left the contents of his studio to the city of Portland, and it wasn't really available till after World War I because it was tied up in Italy during the war. But all those beautiful marble pieces came to Portland in the early 1920s, including the rejected Grant. And of course, you can see the rejected Grant in the rotunda of the Sweat Gallery at the Portland Museum of Art today, and it's an equally wonderful piece to the one in the Capitol.
All right, we're going to take another quick break. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. We're learning about the major figures in Maine's cultural history, whether you've heard of them or not, and how some of them influenced each other. Share your questions or comments. Email us at talk@mainepublic.org, or you can post on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call. The number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. On the line with us now is Professor Marcus Labrizzi with the University of Maine at Machias. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate
so you,
it.
Yeah, you specialize in, I guess, specialize in literary horror, dark fantasy, historical fiction. What makes Maine, do you think, such a great setting for scary stories?
It really is that ghost stories, as I've gone through the different books I've written about Maine and its ghost stories, I found that it's the ghost stories that have helped define Maine's identity and its appeal in the national imagination. Because think about it, they draw on all of the state's iconic qualities, the bold coast, those vast tracts of forest, thousands of islands, basically the unknown. And then there's one other thing I might add. There's a lot of others, but these are some of the really the most prominent. I think the other really big one is how the past seems to persist in the present in Maine, and how Maine has resisted changes seen in other parts of the country. And that persistent past is the keynote of the ghost story.
So, as we already talked about earlier, Stephen King playing such an important part in all of this. But who or who would you add to that list of those who have enriched the culture in this way over the decades?
That's a great question. Yeah, Stephen King definitely, as you had already said, was like brilliantly tapped into that. What I would see that really influenced it, there were writers, individuals, but it was really the people of Maine that have passed it down, the legends and lores that have gone down of ghost ships, of sightings, of women at the sides of the roads that hail passengers. It's really the people and the oral transmission of stories that have gone through generations that have gotten passed down. And then, like I say, those stories resonate with the sense of place that Maine is.
Do you, it's hard for us sometimes, since we live here, to have a sense of what other people in other parts of the United States think of us or how they think of us. But do you think this, that Maine is seen by others as a place where, these ghost stories emerge from that are real or that perpetuate?
Absolutely. Not only is Stephen King, of course, like really tapped into that on a national and international scale, almost every ghost story or scary story that you would see on TV or in the movies, it's always somebody that comes usually from an urban setting or remote rural area, and then their life inextricably changes as they encounter the supernatural or the unknown in that area. And I think that's part of what people see in Maine, not just through popular presentations, but just through the physical landscape, its sense of history, convoluted coastline, pirates, dangerous occupations. And again, like just to resonate with that, the unknown, it's you come here and there's still so much that's unknown.
Yeah, interesting. Marcus Labrizzi, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Marcus Labrizzi, professor of English at the University of Maine at Machias. His most recent book is Haunted Islands in the Gulf of Maine. Earl, any thoughts you wanted to add before we move to architecture?
Let's do architecture.
You have spent some of your career, studying architectural history in Maine, and it's, as we mentioned, it's been in the news recently in the controversy over the Portland Museum of Art expansion project. But let's go back. To some early examples of architecture that was distinctive in Maine and the architects who were doing notable work, and then maybe we can sort of follow it forward, if you will.
Sure.
Where would you start?
Well, I think first we need to define the term architect. Through the 17th, 18th, and into the early 19th century, most buildings in Maine were both designed and constructed by the same individual or the same team of individuals. And this is what we call the architect-builder tradition, in which the design is really springing from the person who then goes out and builds it. And the development of architecture as a separate profession really begins in the 1830s and 40s in Maine. Probably the first person to actually declare themselves specifically to be an architect, and of course he came out of the carpenter builder tradition, but then was largely designing buildings and overseeing their construction, was a fascinating figure in Bangor named Charles G. Bryant. Bryant lived from 1803 to 1850, and he really emerged in the 1830s when Bangor was really becoming the lumber capital, not only of Maine, but really of the United States, shipping vast quantities of lumber out. And the city was just growing very rapidly. In fact, it was the second city in Maine incorporated in 1834. So we have Charles G. Bryant in the 1830s designing very distinctive houses, churches, public buildings in Bangor, and then overseeing their construction. But not actually, to a large degree, being the person who's on the job actually building the building as well. And then in Portland, in the early 1840s, you have a similar development with a man named Thomas J. Sparrow. And he's really considered the first person in Portland to declare himself to be an architect. Again, he comes out of the carpenter tradition, but then he decides, I'm going to take the chance of designing these buildings and overseeing their construction, and I will declare myself an architect. And one of his most notable buildings that is very much a part of the life of the city to this day is Mechanics Hall, built in the 1850s at the corner of Congress and Casco Streets. And then from there, you find by the 1850s, there are primarily in Portland and Bangor, about a dozen men who declare themselves to be architects. And then after the Civil War, the profession just blossoms. And by the turn of the century, there are many professional architects, some of them who have actually been trained in architectural schools that are developing after the Civil War.
John Calvin Stevens comes to mind as a...
Yes, yeah. Stevens is, of course, one of the most well-known figures in Maine architecture. Born in Boston in 1855, he moves with his family to Portland in just 2 years later as a child. Graduates from Portland High School in 1873, wants very much to go to the new architectural school of MIT in Cambridge, but is not able to from standpoint of family means. And so he does the next best thing. He goes into the office to apprentice under Francis H. Fassett, who is then the leading architect in Portland. Very skilled architect who had started work in Bath around 1850. And Stevens quickly advances in that firm, becomes Fassett's junior partner in 1880, and then goes out on his own in 1884. And literally from 1884 until his death in 1940, he is a major force in both Portland and Maine architecture. We estimate that he probably is responsible between Portland and the rest of the state for maybe as many as 1,000 commissions.
So only a few minutes left here, but I want to sort of tie some of these things together. Would you say there's an architectural or evolution of architectural styles that sort of evolves over this time, these 2 centuries that Maine is known for? Or did we just follow the national trends?
Well, to be honest, I think that for the most part, we did follow the national trend as it developed from the colonial to the federal to the Greek Revival to the Romantic styles. Where we became innovative, and this is true also of other parts of New England in the post-Civil War period, is in what we call the shingle style, which of course is a style that Stevens was very important in the formation of, in the development of in the 1880s. And this is a style that really derives its forms from looking back to 17th and 18th century vernacular Maine and New England architecture, and then adapting these styles in a very creative way, largely for residential architecture, for the architecture of summer, for the summer colonies, for the cottages along the coast, but also for some very fine residential architecture, for example, in the West End in Portland. That's an area, the shingle style, where both Maine and New England become very innovative and creative, and it actually, in many ways, leads toward modernism.
We have about 1 minute left, so as succinctly as possible, could you answer an enormous question, which is, how would you could just characterize the impact of Maine artists and creators that they've had on the rest of the world?
Well,
50 seconds or
yeah,
less.
That is a broad question, but I guess I would say that going back to our earlier discussion about what brought the artists to Maine to begin with, there really is... I think there was then, there continues to be today, a Maine mystique, a fascination with our rugged coast, but also with our mountainous inland and northern sections of Maine. And I think it is this this powerful, rugged, honest topography that really continues as it has all through the 19th and 20th century into the 21st to inspire artistic creativity.
Earl Shuttleworth, thank you so much for the hour. Really interesting conversation. Appreciate you being here. Earl Shuttleworth is Maine's longtime state historian. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Visit the Maine Calling website to sign up for our weekly newsletter or to listen to past programs. As a subscriber to the newsletter, you could win a mystery book bundle from the Maine Calling team. Also, there's a quick and easy way to share your thoughts with us. It's the Maine Public Vox Pop app. Download it to your phone and send us voice messages that way. Tomorrow on the program, join me as I talk with the GOP candidates vying to take on Shelley Pingree to represent Maine's 1st Congressional District. This is part of Maine Public's Your Vote 2024 coverage. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.